If you take a perfectly healthy person, right, and you inject them with the exact inflammatory chemicals that you'd find in like a common flu, just the chemicals, within a matter of hours, they will start to exhibit the exact clinical symptoms of major depression.
It's incredible.
Right, their mood just completely drops, they become profoundly exhausted, and their world just literally loses its color.
Yeah.
They develop anhedonia, like the complete inability to feel pleasure. And I bring this up because we tend to view depression as this purely psychological phenomenon, right? Like a ghost in the mental
Right,
machine.
like it's all just in your head.
Exactly. But what if, and this is where we're going today, what if we started treating that biological fire, that physical inflammation, not with conventional steroids or, I don't know, immunosuppressants, but with a microdose of a psychedelic?
I mean, it forces us to just completely reevaluate the entire architecture of human disease
Yeah.
because we have spent, what, the last half century building this artificial wall between psychiatry and immunology.
Oh, completely.
If you have a mood disorder, you go to the psychiatric wing. If you have an autoimmune condition, you go over to rheumatology. But the actual biology of the human body has literally never recognized that wall.
Never. And that biological reality is exactly what we were pulling apart today on this deep dive. So, welcome, everyone.
Glad to be here.
So we are looking at a really paradigm-shifting piece. It was published in the Out of This World Journal, the OOTW Journal, from August 2026, and it's titled Psychedelics and the Immune System: The Anti-Inflammatory Secret.
Such a fascinating paper.
It really is. And for everyone listening to us right now, if you already follow the psychedelic renaissance, you know the standard narrative.
Right.
We know these molecules, psilocybin, LSD, DMT, they are 5-HT2A agonists. We know they act as the gateway to these visionary states, ego dissolution, profound psychological
The
plasticity.
classic trip.
Right, exactly. But that is the neck up conversation. Today, our mission is to completely strip away the visions.
Yeah, we're going neck down.
Yes, entirely neck down. We are looking at a quiet, staggering mechanism where these exact same molecules act as some of the most potent anti-inflammatory compounds ever recorded by modern science.
Which is a reality that honestly remains almost entirely contained within highly specialized pharmacology labs. I mean, the public has no idea.
None at all.
Since we all know the 5-HT2A receptor is the classic gateway for the visionary experience, what is genuinely shocking is finding that exact same receptor plastered all over our vascular tissue, our gut lining, and, our peripheral immune cells.
Okay, let's follow that biology for a second, because we think of the 5-HT2A receptor as this like neural switch sitting up in the cerebral cortex.
Right.
You flip it, the default mode network shifts, your visual cortex alters its processing, and boom, you enter an altered state of consciousness.
But then you map the rest of the human body.
Yeah, and you find these receptors are heavily expressed on endothelial cells, and those are the cells that line the inside of literally every blood vessel in your body.
Every single one.
They're on macrophages. They're on the smooth muscle of your intestines. It's like discovering that the volume knob on your car radio also inexplicably controls your vehicle suspension.
That is a great analogy. Yeah, because evolution is just incredibly conservative.
Right.
When it finds a signaling mechanism that works, it just repurposes it across completely different biological systems.
Don't fix what isn't broken.
Exactly. I mean, serotonin, which is the molecule that normally binds to these receptors, is actually one of the oldest signaling molecules in evolutionary history.
Wow.
You find it in simple organisms that don't even have complex brains. In humans, something like 90% of our serotonin is actually produced in the gut, not the brain.
Wait, 90%.
Yeah, it regulates digestion, it controls blood vessel constriction, and immune responses.
Okay, so this receptor basically has a hidden second job.
Precisely. So when a psychedelic molecule enters the bloodstream and binds to a 5-HT2A receptor on a physical immune cell or a vascular cell, it doesn't trigger a hallucination.
Because it's not in the brain.
Right. It triggers an intracellular cascade that essentially closes the valve on the immune system's inflammatory response. It operates as an immunomodulator.
I want to get into the specific mechanics of how that valve gets closed because the history of this discovery is just fascinating. We actually have to go back to 2013, right, to Charles Nichols's lab.
Yes.
This is the landmark study that really just ripped the lid off this entire field.
The Nichols lab was investigating inflammation, but they were approaching it from a really highly specific angle. They were working with a research chemical called RDOI. Now,
Okay.
RDOI is a synthetic psychedelic. It's not found in nature, And it's definitely not something used in psychiatric therapy.
So why use a synthetic? I think that's the obvious question here. Like, when you have well-known molecules like LSD or psilocin, why use this obscure chemical?
It all comes down to selectivity.
Okay.
Classic psychedelics are chemically, well, we call them noisy.
Noisy.
Yeah. LSD, for example, doesn't just bind to the 5-HT2A receptor.
Yeah.
It also hits dopamine receptors. It hits a whole variety of other serotonin receptors.
Oh, I see.
So if you are a cellular biologist and you're trying to understand exactly what one specific receptor does, you need a key that only fits one single lock.
Right. Otherwise, you don't know which lock is actually opening the door.
Exactly.
Yeah.
RDOI is that perfect key. It binds with extreme affinity and selectivity to just the 5-HT2A receptor, which allows researchers to isolate the exact mechanism without all that background biological noise.
Okay, so they administer this highly selective molecule, RDOI, to these animal models. And what they observe in the raw data is something that initially made them like question their own instruments.
Yeah, they thought they made a mistake.
Right, because they discovered that RDOI blocked TNF-alpha. And TNF-alpha, which stands for tumor necrosis factor alpha, is basically the undisputed master driver of inflammation in the mammalian body.
It is the biological alarm bell.
Yep.
When your body detects a pathogen or tissue damage or some irritant, your macrophages release TNF-alpha to basically rally the immune system.
It's calling in the troops.
Exactly. It initiates a massive cascade. It tells your blood vessels to dilate. It recruits other white blood cells to the area. It is the absolute genesis of the biological fire.
And the data showed that RDOI didn't just, you know, slightly dampen the signal. It shut down the downstream pro-inflammatory genes completely.
Completely silenced them.
We are talking about genes like IL-6, ICAM-1, and VCAM-1.
And to understand how monumental that is, we really have to look at what those genes actually do.
Let's hear it.
So ICAM-1 and VCAM-1 are what we call adhesion molecules.
Okay.
Imagine the inside of a healthy blood vessel as a perfectly smooth, like Teflon tube.
Very slippery.
Right. Blood just flows through it effortlessly. But when TNF-alpha sounds the alarm, it triggers the transcription of ICAM-1 and VCAM-1.
And what do they do?
These proteins are literally pushed to the surface of the endothelial cells, turning that smooth Teflon into biological Velcro.
Oh, wow. So that circulating immune cells can actually stick to the walls of the blood vessel and pull themselves into the infected tissue.
Exactly. It's an essential survival mechanism if you have a localized infection, like, say, a cut on your arm.
Right. You want the white blood cells to stop there and fight the bacteria.
Yes. But if that system is chronically activated across your entire body, if that Velcro is just always exposed everywhere, you get chronic systemic inflammation.
Which is the root of so many diseases.
Exactly. So the Nichols lab found that binding RDOI to the 5-HT2A receptor effectively trapped that inflammatory pathway inside the cell, preventing the DNA from ever reading the instructions to build the Velcro in the first place.
Okay, the mechanism they identified for this relies on the NFKB pathway, right?
Yes, NFKB.
Let's break that down, because I feel like this is the how behind the what. How does a molecule binding to the outside of a cell stop a gene from being read deep inside the nucleus?
It comes down to intracellular signaling.
Right.
NFKB is this protein complex that acts as a transcription factor. Normally, it just sits quietly in the cytoplasm of the cell, basically held hostage by an inhibitor protein.
Right.
When an inflammatory signal like TNF-alpha hits the outside of the cell, it triggers these enzymes that destroy that inhibitor.
So the hostage is freed.
The hostage is freed.
Huh.
And NFKB immediately travels deep into the nucleus of the cell, binds to the DNA, and says, start manufacturing IL-6, start making the ICAM-1 and VCAM-1.
Start making the Velcro.
Yes. But what the Nichols lab discovered is that when RDOI binds to the 5-HT2A receptor, the receptor undergoes this structural shapeshift.
Okay.
And this shift sends a completely different chemical messenger into the cell that disrupts that entire inflammatory cascade. It essentially prevents the inhibitor from being destroyed.
So NFKB stays trapped in the cytoplasm.
Exactly. It never makes it to the nucleus. The inflammatory genes remain completely silent.
That is just biological wizardry, I mean, honestly. But here is the detail that truly elevates this from, you know, an interesting lab finding to a potential revolution in medicine.
Yeah, the potency.
Right. They didn't achieve this gene silencing by flooding the system with the drug. They achieved it at picomolar concentrations.
Picomolar is a measurement that forces pharmacologists to just lean in and check the math.
Yeah, let's contextualize what a picomolar concentration actually is for everyone listening, because saying very small does not do the physics justice.
Not at all.
So a mole is a standard unit of measurement in chemistry for a specific number of molecules, right? A micromole is 1/1,000,000th of a mole. A nanomole is 1/1,000,000,000th.
Right.
A picomole is 1/1,000,000,000th of a mole.
Yeah, it's almost impossible to picture.
It is a concentration so infinitesimally low that it borders on the homeopathic, yet they were measuring dominant systemic physiological effects.
We are talking about trace amounts of a substance fundamentally overriding the most powerful inflammatory pathways in whole living animal models.
It's like a single drop of ink altering the color of an Olympic-sized swimming pool.
That's exactly what it's like. The researchers administered these picomolar doses and observed a complete block of systemic inflammation in the vasculature and the gut.
Okay, hold on, because this is where the biology seems to contradict itself to me.
How so?
If we are shutting down master inflammatory pathways like TNF-alpha across an entire living organism and doing it with a psychedelic compound, there is no way the animal wouldn't be hallucinating its mind off.
Right.
Like, you can't alter systemic biology to that extreme, placing it in a league with the strongest known biological immunosuppressants without blowing out the neural circuits that cause the trip.
Right. It is the most vital objection you could raise.
Yeah.
And it is exactly why the pharmaceutical industry is pouring so much capital into this specific mechanism right now. Your assumption is totally logical. If the systemic effect is this profound, the cognitive effect must be deafening. But the data shows the exact opposite.
Wait, really? The physical effect occurs without the cognitive effect?
Completely independently. The threshold for the immunomodulatory effect, the anti-inflammatory cooling, is picomolar.
Okay.
The threshold for behavioral changes, which indicate hallucinogenic activity in animal models, is vastly higher. It requires microgram or even milligram doses.
That is a massive difference.
There is a massive separation in the dose response curve. A mere fraction of a behaviorally active dose is enough to completely switch off inflammatory gene expression in the vascular tissue.
So the immune system basically responds to a molecular whisper, while the cerebral cortex requires a shout.
That is exactly the dynamic. And it opens a door that has historically been slammed shut in psychedelic medicine.
Because if you can separate the physical benefit from the hallucinogenic journey, you remove the biggest logistical barrier to this being an accessible daily medication.
Yes.
You're talking about developing non-hallucinogenic psychedelics.
Which is huge. We have a massive global population suffering from chronic inflammatory diseases.
Yes.
Asthma, atherosclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, inflammatory bowel disease.
Yeah, millions of people.
In all of these conditions, the immune system is stuck in an aggressive on position. In atherosclerosis, for example, the endothelial dysfunction is driven by that exact VCAM1 Velcro we just talked about.
Right.
Macrophages get stuck to the blood vessel walls, they burrow in, they consume oxidized cholesterol, and they form the plaques that eventually cause heart attacks.
And currently, the way we treat these severe chronic conditions is by using biologics, right? Drugs that specifically target and neutralize TNF-alpha.
Yes. Drugs like Humira or Remicade.
Right.
They are incredibly effective for many people, but they come with significant drawbacks.
Like what?
Well, they are large, complex proteins. They have to be injected or infused. They are staggeringly expensive to manufacture. And because they broadly neutralize TNF-alpha circulating in the blood, they can leave the patient highly vulnerable to severe opportunistic infections.
Because you're basically turning off the body's fire department globally?
Exactly.
But with a molecule based on the RDOI scaffold, you're talking about a small molecule drug, something you could just take as a daily pill.
A daily pill that penetrates the tissues deeply, binds to the 5-HT2A receptors, and halts the inflammation at the cellular transcription level.
Wow.
All without inducing any perceptual changes. You could theoretically treat the root cause of asthma, the severe airway inflammation and smooth muscle constriction, by taking a medication derived from psychedelic geometry, and then just drive your kids to school and have a completely normal Tuesday.
That completely upends the current pharmaceutical landscape. I mean, it's just incredible.
It really is.
But as we know, the body doesn't exist in a vacuum, right? And neither does the brain. We've established that subperceptual doses calm the blood vessels and the gut. But if we track these exact same inflammatory mechanisms up through the blood-brain barrier into the central nervous system, things get incredibly profound.
They do, because the brain possesses its own bespoke immune system.
Okay, let's get into this.
It is not relying on the white blood cells circulating in your blood. The brain relies on a specialized class of cells called microglia.
Right, let's talk about the microglia. They are often described in the literature as the brain's immune sentinels. But I think a much better way to visualize them for everyone listening is as the brain's arborists.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah. So in a healthy brain, these microglia are highly motile. They have these long, beautiful branching arms that are constantly reaching out, scanning the neural environment.
It's checking on everything.
Right. They prune dead synaptic branches. They clean up cellular debris. They ensure the neural network stays optimized and healthy.
They're maintaining the structural integrity of the forest.
Exactly. But when they encounter a threat, like when they detect inflammatory cytokines crossing the blood-brain barrier or signals of cellular damage, they undergo a radical physical transformation.
They're too dramatic.
They pull those long branching arms back in. They become amoeboid, like these little blobs. They essentially drop the pointing shears and they pick up chainsaws.
Yeah. They transition into what is called the M1 phenotype.
Right.
Which is a highly aggressive, pro-inflammatory state.
And in this M1 state, they begin secreting massive amounts of reactive oxygen species and their own TNF-alpha directly into the brain tissue.
It's a scorched earth policy.
Yes. They indiscriminately cut down healthy synaptic connections in their attempt to eradicate the perceived threat. And this state is what we call neuroinflammation.
And neuroinflammation isn't just a minor headache.
No.
According to the current neurological consensus, it is heavily implicated in the pathology of Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and major depressive disorder.
A brain suffering from these conditions is literally a brain on fire.
Exactly. The arborists have gone completely rogue.
Which brings us back to the classic psychedelics, psilocybin, LSD, DMT. When these molecules cross the blood-brain barrier and bind to the 5-HT2A receptors located on these microglia, they initiate that same intracellular halt to the NFKB pathway.
They force the microglia to put down the chainsaws.
Yes. They quiet the neuroinflammation by dialing down the pro-inflammatory cytokines.
But it's not just a cessation of hostilities, which is the coolest part.
Right, there's more.
The data shows that certain tryptamines actually induce the production of IL-10.
Now, IL-10 is an anti-inflammatory cytokine.
It is the biological fire extinguisher.
Exactly. So they aren't just stopping the microglia from releasing toxic chemicals. They are actively forcing them to transition from that destructive M1 phenotype back to the restorative M2 phenotype.
They are commanding the cells to start repairing the damage.
Yes. And this repair process is intimately linked to the MTOR pathway, isn't it?
The MTOR pathway, the mechanistic target of rapamycin.
Right.
This is a central, absolutely critical kinase in cellular biology.
Right.
It acts as the master sensor for nutrient availability and cellular energy.
Okay.
In the brain, when the MTOR pathway is activated, it signals the neurons to synthesize new proteins, to grow new dendritic spines. It is the biochemical engine of neuroplasticity.
So it's literally the ability of the brain to rewire itself.
Yes. And what we see under the influence of these molecules is that the brain's chemistry shifts violently away from neurotoxic metabolites, the damaging byproducts of a burning brain, and moves toward neuroprotective ones.
It creates an environment where MTOR can actually function again.
Precisely.
Which, I mean, this forces a really compelling realization for me.
Yeah.
Because the entire psychedelic therapeutic model currently revolves around neuroplasticity. Like, the whole idea is that the intense visionary experience shakes the snow globe, right? And neurogenesis allows the brain to form new, healthier pathways to route around trauma or these rigid thought loops.
That's the current model, yes.
But neurogenesis is incredibly expensive from a biological standpoint, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It requires massive amounts of cellular energy and raw materials to build new synaptic connections.
So if a brain is caught in a state of chronic neuroinflammation, it is in a defensive survival state.
Yes.
The resources are being hoarded to fight a fire. It literally cannot afford the energy to grow. So does this mean that the famous neuroplasticity caused by psychedelics is actually just a downstream consequence of a calm immune system? Like, is it simply that a brain on fire cannot rewire itself and the psychedelic's primary physical action is just putting out the fire so the forest can grow again?
You are touching on the absolute bleeding edge of psychiatric theory right there.
Really?
Yeah. It is the transition from viewing neuroplasticity as this magical standalone event to viewing it as an ecological necessity.
An ecological necessity?
Wow. Because you cannot plant seeds in a burning forest.
Right.
The biological priority of an inflamed system is containment, not expansion. by profoundly cooling the physiological fire, by turning the microglia back into peaceful arborists, and flooding the environment with IL-10. The psychedelic fundamentally alters the cellular ecology.
It resets the soil.
Exactly. Only when the environment shifts from neurotoxic to neuroprotective can the MTOR pathway engage. The plasticity is entirely dependent on that initial radical cooling of the brain's immune response.
If we accept that if we know psychedelics put out the fire in the microglia, and we know that a burning brain creates the exact clinical symptoms of depression, it forces us to completely rethink what an antidepressant actually is.
It changes everything.
And this brings us to the dual-action antidepressant theory.
Yes.
Yeah.
This theory represents the complete synthesis of the neurological and the immunological. Over the last two decades, the cytokine hypothesis of depression has moved from the fringes of psychiatry into the mainstream.
Which is huge.
We now have irrefutable data showing that a substantial subset of patients suffering from treatment-resistant depression have significantly elevated inflammatory markers in their blood.
We're talking about markers like C-reactive protein, right?
C-reactive protein, elevated levels of IL-6. This isn't just a psychosomatic feeling of sadness.
Right.
There is a measurable systemic physical fire burning in their vasculature, which is crossing the blood-brain barrier and activating their microglia.
It's what evolutionary biologists call sickness behavior, right?
Exactly.
Like there's an evolutionary advantage to depression.
Precisely. If you are a primitive human and you contract a severe viral infection, your immune system releases massive amounts of cytokines.
Okay.
Those cytokines tell your brain to initiate sickness behavior. You withdraw socially, you lose your appetite, you lose the ability to feel pleasure, and you sleep.
Because you need to conserve energy so the immune system has the fuel to fight the virus.
Right.
It basically keeps you from wandering out of the cave and getting eaten by a predator while you're weak and sick.
It is a brilliant survival mechanism.
Yeah, historically.
But in modern humans, this inflammatory cascade can be triggered chronically by stress, poor diet, autoimmune issues, or environmental toxins.
The brain misinterprets all this chronic peripheral inflammation as a constant severe infection.
Yes. The patient is locked into perpetual sickness behavior. We call it depression, but biologically, it is an immune system caught in a feedback loop.
Which is where the 5-HT2A agonist enters the picture, attacking the disease from two completely different directions simultaneously. The dual action hypothesis?
Exactly. Direction one is the psychological action.
The trip.
The visionary, therapeutic experience. The ego dissolution that allows a patient to process deep-seated trauma, to break out of the rigid, ruminative thought loops of the default mode network.
It is the conscious, top-down, cognitive rewiring.
Right. But direction two is the biological action we've been uncovering today. The quiet, profound, physical cooling of systemic and neuroinflammation.
The physiological baseline being forcibly reset.
This is the end of Cartesian dualism in psychiatry.
That's a bold statement, but I get it.
The philosophy that the mind and the body exist as separate entities is biologically false.
Yeah.
The psychedelic is a whole body event. It touches on the gut-brain axis. It quiets the endothelium. It calms the microglia. It heals the mind by aggressively healing the body that generates it.
But if we follow that logic to its absolute extreme, and I want to push this a bit because it's fascinating, it raises a deeply provocative question about clinical application.
Okay, let's hear it.
Let's say a patient is suffering from severe anhedonia and depression. But their depression isn't rooted in a profound childhood trauma or a psychological complex.
Right, it's biological.
It is entirely driven by a chronically inflamed gut-brain axis that is keeping their microglia in that toxic M1 state.
Okay.
If their depression is purely a downstream symptom of physical inflammation, could the hallucinogenic trip be completely unnecessary for their cure?
That is the pivotal question for the future of psychopharmacology right now.
Because if we just gave them a daily subperceptual picomolar dose of a highly selective 5-HT2A agonist to cool the biological fire, would their depression just evaporate without them ever needing to put on an eye mask, listen to ambient music, and, you know, confront the fabric of the universe for 8 hours?
If the dual action hypothesis holds true, the answer for a specific subset of patients is unequivocally yes.
Wow.
For individuals whose psychiatric symptoms are primarily the result of peripheral inflammation driving neuroinflammation, cooling the body is the mechanism of relief.
The biological baseline of their mood is dictated by the absence of inflammatory cytokines.
Exactly. For them, a non-hallucinogenic immunomodulator could be a complete cure.
It's basically a mechanical fix for a mechanical problem.
It is. However, human beings are rarely that cleanly categorized.
Fair point.
For the vast majority of people, depression is a heavily tangled knot. It is a combination of physiological inflammation, deeply entrenched psychological trauma, environmental stressors, and rigid behavioral patterns.
It's everything all at once.
In those complex cases, the visionary experience is absolutely vital. The trip allows the patient to gain a new perspective, to confront their grief, to consciously desire change.
Well, underneath the hood, the molecule is cooling the inflammation that made their brain too rigid to change in the first place.
Exactly. It is a holistic, interdependent healing loop. The cooling of the biological fire provides the fertile, neuroprotective soil, and the visionary psychological experience plants the new seeds.
It's incredibly elegant. But as elegant as that dual action model is, rigorous science demands that we look at the boundaries of the data.
Always.
We have to draw a hard line between compelling laboratory mechanisms and settled clinical facts. Because right now, the psychedelic space is just flooded with hype, and it is very easy to blur that line.
Critical thinking is the only way this field survives its own renaissance.
Yeah.
Let's look at the limitations.
First, the most dramatic potency data, that mind-bending picomolar shutdown of TNF-alpha we were talking about earlier, that comes from RDOI.
Right.
And as we noted, this is a highly specific synthetic research chemical. Furthermore, the strongest evidence for this profound systemic immunomodulation exists primarily in vitro cellular assays and in vivo animal models, like the mice in the Nichols studies.
And while the basic mechanics of the mammalian immune system are highly conserved, translating a biological mechanism from a mouse model to a human being is fraught with complexity.
Right, a mouse is not a small human.
Exactly. The scale, the metabolic rate, the intricate variables of a human immune system introduce factors that a controlled lab environment simply cannot account for.
Which leads to the biggest unknown in the current psychiatric application of psychedelics. We do not yet have large-scale, definitive human clinical trials proving that the specific doses of psilocybin used in depression therapy today, typically, what, a 25-milligram dose of synthetic psilocybin?
Yes, 25 milligrams is the standard.
You don't have proof that that specific dose is producing a clinically meaningful, long-term anti-inflammatory effect in the human body.
We know human 5-HT2A receptors function fundamentally the same way as those in the animal models.
Sure.
We know they initiate the same intracellular cascades.
Right.
But isolating and proving that the inflammation-lowering effect is the definitive biological reason a human patient recovers from depression amidst the profound noise of the psychological experience is incredibly difficult to measure.
Because there's just so much going on.
Right. We are operating on a highly compelling, biologically sound hypothesis, but it has not yet crossed the threshold into settled textbook medical fact.
So just to challenge the premise one more time for everyone listening, despite the staggering cellular data, we cannot state with absolute certainty that a person undergoing psilocybin-assisted therapy is experiencing a systemic immune reset that is responsible for their cured depression.
We can confidently say their 5-HT2A receptors are being activated globally, and we know what that activation does in isolated tissue.
Right.
But drawing a straight, unbroken causal line from that cellular mechanism to the resolution of complex human psychiatric disease in a clinical setting is the frontier we are actively trying to map right now. It is highly probable, but is not yet proven.
There is also a vital biological reality check that needs to be addressed here, because it is very easy to fall into the binary thinking that inflammation is evil and anti-inflammatory is good.
Oh, absolutely.
Inflammation is the bedrock of human survival. It is how we neutralize bacterial infections, how we fight off viruses, how we repair physical trauma, and how we identify and destroy early-stage cancer cells.
If you recklessly blunt your immune system's ability to produce TNF-alpha or IL-6, you are turning off your internal security apparatus.
The guards are asleep.
If the fire department is asleep, a minor localized infection can rapidly become systemic sepsis.
Which is why the idea of self-experimentation, you know, with chronic dosing of psychedelics to quote-unquote lower inflammation, is biologically dangerous.
It is playing with the master switches of human biology without a map.
Yeah.
The ultimate goal of immunological medicine is never eradication. It is homeostasis. It is returning a hyperactive, confused immune system back to a baseline of appropriate, measured response.
Looking back over the terrain we've covered today, the sheer scale of the biology is just breathtaking.
It really is.
We started with the classic psychedelic gateway, the 5-HT2A receptor in the brain, but we tracked it down into the blood vessels and the gut. We saw how binding a highly selective molecule to that receptor at infinitesimally small peak molar concentrations triggers an intracellular structural shift.
A shift that physically traps the NFKB pathway in the cytoplasm, preventing the DNA transcription of the master inflammatory genes.
We watched that molecular whisper turn off the biological Velcro, VSAM1, in the vasculature, shutting down systemic inflammation at doses vastly below the threshold for hallucination, which opens an entirely new frontier for treating conditions like asthma and atherosclerosis without the cognitive trip.
Then we followed that mechanism across the blood-brain barrier.
Back to the microglia. We saw how these molecules force the brain's arborists to drop their chainsaws, transitioning from the toxic M1 state to the restorative M2 state, releasing IL-10, and cooling the neuroinflammation that suffocates a depressed brain. And finally, we explored the dual-action antidepressant theory, the profound realization that neuroplasticity might only be possible once the physiological fire is extinguished, permanently linking the healing of the mind to the healing of the body.
I really hope the next time you, the listener, encounter a study about psychedelic therapy in the news, you will possess a biological lens that very few people have right now.
Absolutely.
While the cultural conversation remains fixated on the visions and the psychological breakthroughs, you will understand the quiet, immense cellular mechanics operating beneath the surface. You will see the immune system at work.
But there is one final lingering paradox embedded in this biology that I just can't shake. We know that inflammation is our evolutionary armor, right? It is our body's primal defense mechanism against a hostile physical world.
Yes.
And we now know that the exact same molecule that possesses the super potency to instantly shut that defense down, to strip our biological armor away, is the exact same molecule that so profoundly expands human consciousness.
It's a wild thought.
Why are those two functions wired to the identical biological switch? Does the human animal have to temporarily surrender its physical defenses to become entirely biologically vulnerable in order to achieve true cognitive expansion and connection?
It is a biological mystery disguised as a philosophical question.
It really is something to chew on as you move through your day. Keep questioning the consensus, keep looking for the hidden mechanics underneath the surface, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.